Welcome to St. Louis on the Air and today's Legal Roundtable. Uber's up and running and the courts along for the ride. How would you feel if you won the lottery and there was no payoff? Well, Illinois winners can tell you how it feels, and they're going to court. The Ferguson Commission's recommendations are out, but it will take some new law to implement them. Is that likely? And what's ahead for the new term of the U.S. Supreme Court? I'm Don Morris. Just some of the things our roundtable panelists will discuss. They're all attorneys. Bill Freivogel is journalism professor at Southern Illinois University in Carbondale. Mark Smith is associate vice chancellor at Washington University, where he also directs the Career Center. Also from Washington University and his School of Law, Professor Ron Levin. Thank you all so much for being with us. Nice to have you.
Good afternoon.
Ron, to you first. Welcome.
Thank you so much. Happy to be here.
So we'll start with you. I want to get into this Uber thing. It's a front page story the last couple of days. And Uber, the ride-sharing organization, it's up and running in St. Louis and St. Louis County, as I understand it, at the present time. But there's an antitrust suit that has been filed. Tell me about that. I'm confused as to how antitrust works its way into the Uber case.
Right. So Uber says St. Louis is the largest metropolitan area in which Uber is not permitted to operate. And in order to try to break into that market and respond to the demand that they see, they have decided to just start operating and challenge the validity of the taxicab commission rules that say they should not be operating. And one way they're challenging it is by bringing an antitrust suit. And the nature of that suit is to say that the rules passed by the Taxicab Commission are an unlawful restraint of trade. There's a federal statute that prohibits combinations in restraint of trade, and this is at least a somewhat credible suit because the Federal Trade Commission, which enforces the antitrust laws, has actually endorsed Uber on the national level, not specifically with reference to St. Louis, but they say if a taxicab commission, which is staffed largely by representatives of the taxi industry, tries to keep out competition, that is unlawful, and therefore the court should say that the restrictions are invalid, and therefore Uber is free to do as it's doing.
Unless a restraining order is filed, this thing is going to go on forever, and Uber is going to be well into St. Louis and St. Louis County before this ever gets to the courts, isn't it?
I think that could happen. Yeah, I think that the antitrust case itself, although it may have merit as a legal matter, antitrust cases take a long time to litigate. So I see this as being at least in part a public relations effort, as opposed to one that they really think will result in a judgment. I think the idea is that if they are here and keeping up their public relations campaign, there'll be enough public support that they'll get permission to operate.
And all this centers on fingerprinting of Uber drivers. And you know something about that part of the story.
I know a little bit about it. So they say there's a restraint of trade, but what it really comes down to is that the commission is saying nobody can operate as a taxi cab type service unless they allow for the right kind of security checks, and we require all taxicab applicants to get fingerprinted. Uber doesn't have that policy. Therefore, it's not that we don't like them. It's just that they aren't following the right procedures. Well, Uber's position nationally is fingerprinting is not necessary and that they have alternative checks that do just as good a job. They do courthouse checks of people who want to work for them. They say we have some control because the nature of this app is that nobody can participate unless we know who's responding to a given call. And as far as fingerprinting goes, I happen to have a friend in the American Bar Association, one of my colleagues, who represents Uber. And I won't vouch for this myself, but I'll tell you this is what he says, that fingerprinting is really not that good a device because many people get fingerprinted when they're arrested, but they're never convicted. And yet the municipality doesn't purge the fingerprints from the file or put something to indicate that the person really was never convicted. And he says that in Baltimore, 90% of the people arrested were not convicted. And so you have a lot of false positives in the situation. So what's so great about fingerprinting is their point.
I see. Mark, as a former member of the police board, my understanding, the latest that I've seen anyway, is that the city police are not going to bother stopping these folks. The county cops will, however.
Well, what I've seen is the city said, we just got too much other stuff to do, and that makes sense. They've got limited resources, and they've got to put their priorities where it's most important. I think the county has said they will, but only if they're stopping for some other reason. They won't just try and – they're not going to be running sting operations on these.
They have to have probable cause.
Cause for something else, I think, not that they're an unlicensed taxi cab.
All right. Bill, how are you looking at this whole thing?
Well, I agree with what Ron was saying. And on the antitrust end of things, there's a reference in the Uber complaint to a Supreme Court decision that was just earlier this year. And it I won't get into all the details, but it basically was where dentists were mad that tooth whiteners were undercutting their price. And there was a dental board that was sort of controlled by the dentist, just like this taxi cab board seems to be controlled by taxi cab interests. And the Supreme Court basically ended up ruling on the side of the discount tooth whiteners.
But this is a natural tension in the law. This on the one hand, you have this this tendency against monopoly, and on the other side, you have protecting the public. And so, you know, the legal profession, even though you, Don, know a lot about the law, you can't go out and start practicing law saying, you know, I do this show every month. I've figured out enough. Because – and we as lawyers say the reason is because we're protecting the public. But those who are less charitable to lawyers might
say – I'll take my chances myself.
might say, well, maybe what the lawyers are really doing is – keeping out new entrants into the field just to keep costs up so the lawyers are more profitable.
Okay. Well, the bottom line is that Uber is going to be running for the foreseeable future and maybe for a good long while before any of this is resolved. Let's move along to the Ferguson Commission report. I'm sure everyone here is conversant with the basics of that report. And we've talked about this, the regular panelists have talked about some of these things before, but a number of issues have been brought to the fore, recommendations, calls to action they're called. Use of force, we're familiar, we've discussed that. They're talking about expanding Medicaid in the state of Missouri, increasing the minimum wage, civilian review, and police and court consolidation. Bill, I'll start with you on this. There's an awful lot of law that has to be written by a legislature that, as we've seen, doesn't seem predisposed to want to deal with many of these issues.
Right. Well, this use of force statute in Missouri, it was teed up for the last legislature, and they didn't get the job done. There were a bunch of bills. None of them passed. And none of them really addressed the issue very well, even though the grand jury investigation of the Darren Wilson shooting of Michael Brown very much showed how there was uncertainty about what the law on use of force by police officers was in Missouri, and where there's a conflict basically between what the statute says and what the Missouri Supreme Court rules say. So, yes, I think it's a good recommendation to fix that. But you know, we'll see whether the legislature is any more effective. You know, another one of their suggestions is this one about having the attorney general be in charge of prosecutions on police use of force. And I guess the Missouri Highway Patrol would be the investigative agency. And I would say that recommendation, while I can understand the reasons behind it, I don't think is going to go anywhere. Bob McCullough is a very powerful person in the Missouri legislature and the Missouri Democratic Party. He pointed out the other day that, well, maybe he'd just run for attorney general.
Yeah.
And how would people like that? And think about our most recent attorneys general. Do we think that that John Ashcroft and Bill Webster and Jay Nixon and even Koster would be just really aggressive at prosecuting police use of force cases? I'm not convinced that they would have been.
Yeah, you're going to be more likely to have somebody in a local election who's more in tune than a statewide candidate. I agree with that. I think I don't see that going through.
And Ron, another issue is expanding Medicaid, and we all know that that is something that just has no legs at all in the Missouri legislature.
Well, I think there's a certain proportion of the Ferguson Commission recommendations like that, which raise issues that go well beyond the issues of this of their charge. And I don't think that means it's irrelevant. I think you would have less racial tension probably if people in the community are getting health insurance that they can't afford.
And the health care that goes along with it. That's exactly. That's the issue.
So it makes sense from that standpoint. But on the other hand, it involves such larger issues, it would just be one input in a much larger debate.
Right.
Same as consolidation of municipalities. I think they are logical in saying it would be a good idea from their standpoint. But so many other interests are in play that whether there's a Ferguson Commission recommendation on that point, these points, or not, isn't going to matter very much. People will use it as a debating point. But what happens to Medicaid expansion or consolidation is going to depend on a lot of other things.
Yeah, well, Maria Chappelle Nadal, whose district includes Ferguson, said most of these things have no chance at all in Jefferson City. One of the other issues here, and I'll tie these together with a couple of things, is the minimum wage. The Ferguson Commission also proposes an increase in the minimum wage. But here's what we've got going on with regard to that. Missouri legislature has blocked cities in the most recent session from increasing the minimum wage. That is apparently going to involve some court action at some point. A suit has been filed against the city against implementation of a proposed $11 an hour minimum wage. But the Ferguson Commission has recommended a minimum wage increase to $15 an hour. It seems to me that the minimum wage thing is another boat that's dead in the water, pretty much. Any thoughts on that?
I guess maybe the St. Louis minimum wage law that would go up to $11 in, I think, 2018. I think that is probably still alive because the bill that was passed by the legislature over the governor's veto said in it that any bills, any laws in effect before the passage of the bill could still operate. And there's at least an argument to be made that the St. Louis ordinance was in effect beforehand, even though the actual provisions of the first increase in the minimum wage didn't take effect yet.
Right.
Well, the challengers who have brought suit, basically the business interests to challenge that law, are saying, well, even aside from what the legislature has been doing this session, there are past laws that preempt by the state level to prevent the city from doing what it proposes to do.
Yeah.
So I think, you know, if that is what the laws say, it's troubling because it would imply that the state is in a good position to assess the economic merits of minimum wage increases in all the different localities of St. Louis, which doesn't seem terribly likely. I think there probably isn't. Are decent arguments on both sides about whether $11 increase is economically justified, but I just don't see the state of Missouri, the legislature, being in a good position to appraise that as well as the locality.
I don't think that the legislature, the state legislature, would change it. But one of the interesting things, the Kansas City city councilor did a little memo saying, I think we can't raise the minimum wage. I think it's preempted by state. And preempted means that, and you use it more often with federal law. If the feds kind of pass laws in an area, then the state can't do the same thing. And we've talked about preemption before on your show. And so it's the same thing with the state and the city. But he said after this legislation came through and it said, well, but if anything gets passed by August 28th, I think that was the date, then it's okay. And now he's saying, well, I think we're safe then. So I think the city's got not a bad argument and they seem prepared to fight it. So we'll
and I guess right before the veto was overridden, didn't Judge Omer refuse to put the St. Louis ordinance to delay its effect?
Right.
But I think
that's true.
There's going to be
a hearing in mid-October or
something,
hearing, I think.
Right.
Yeah.
Well, let's take a break. We'll come back and talk about many other things that we have on our list for today. It's Legal Roundtable Day. My guests in studio are Ron Levin from Washington University School of Law, We have Bill Freivogel with us, as usual, and he's from SIU in Carbondale, and Mark Smith, also from Washington University. Back to continue the conversation in a moment. This is St. Louis on the Air on St. Louis Public Radio, 90.7 KWMU. Hello again and welcome back. It's Legal Roundtable Panel Day today, and we'll continue our conversation with our three lawyers in just a moment. But first, here are some of the stories our St. Louis Public Radio newsroom is following today. Missouri Governor Jay Nixon is expected to announce this afternoon a proposed funding increase for public colleges and universities during what he has billed as a major announcement regarding higher education funding and affordability. And data from the Illinois Secretary of State's office show more than 5,000 Illinoisans who were convicted of drunken driving and had their licenses revoked could legally drive again under a new state law. Governor Bruce Rauner last month signed the measure, which would provide restricted driving permits if affected drivers prove they are drug and alcohol free for at least 3 years. Join St. Louis Public Radio this afternoon for local and regional news and throughout the day on our website at stlpublicradio.org. Very, very briefly here, we've been talking a little bit about the legislature and the legislative veto session that's just ended. There is another issue that was dealt with by the legislature in this session that is likely to have some future court action, and that is a cut in unemployment benefits. Anyone have any thought on that potential?
Well, I guess I'm not sure I've thought this through entirely, but I would guess that the state legislature would be able to do that. I don't know exactly what the legal challenge to it would be, unless it conflicts with some sort of federal law.
Yeah. I think it does law. Because it's a state unemployment. It's not a federal. So I would think. I mean, I'm sure there'll be a challenge, but and I guess part of it is contingent on unemployment being at a certain level, and then if employment drops a certain level, then you only get, what, like 13 weeks instead of 20 or something like that. So maybe there's some argument that, you know, that doesn't make sense. But
I think it's primarily a political argument.
Yeah, I think so, too.
As opposed to a legal dispute.
Yeah, I think it's anticipated, but no one has yet defined who exactly might make that challenge. Okay, I want to talk about the next term of the Supreme Court now, and we'll get back to some other locally related issues in a moment. Bill, we'll start with you with regard to what are you looking for? It's 2 weeks from today, I guess, that the court will convene. Is that correct? First Monday in October?
Yeah, October 5th, I think it is.
Yeah,
first Monday in October all the time. And, I mean, I think it's one interesting thing about the time we're going through right now is that in the last Republican debate, the Supreme Court was really teed up by a number of the presidential candidates, I guess Ted Cruz in particular, who said that he regretted having voted for Chief Justice Roberts. And I guess he sort of followed up by saying that the Democrats all vote like radical socialists. And, meanwhile, the Republican presidents can't seem to nominate people who will vote reliably in the conservative way. He went through sort of like a history of the Supreme Court that Chief Justice Warren and Brennan and Blackmun and Souter and Stevens were all Republican appointees, but they all turn out to be liberals. And, meanwhile, all the Democratic appointees basically turn out to be these, in his words, wild-eyed socialists.
It's all triggered, I guess, primarily by Obamacare and by same-sex marriage. I suppose that has the wrath of people like Ted Cruz particularly piqued.
Well, Ted Cruz is trying to cultivate support among the most conservative wing of the Republican Party by saying even moderate Republicans represent sellouts, and therefore we need someone who is a Simon Pure Republican as opposed to someone who will sometimes compromise with Democrats. And I imagine Democrats love to hear that kind of talk because they think their chances go up if the Republican Party is driven a little more to the right as Cruz seems to try to seek.
And this criticism of Roberts, I mean, yeah, he upheld the Obamacare law, mm-hmm. but He also, there were five votes saying the Commerce Clause doesn't go that far. That's a big, that's a huge deal. I mean, it's kind of lurking in the background. But, you know, when I was in law school, the consensus was the Commerce Clause, which is the basis for most federal legislation or much of it, you could basically pass anything and connect it to interstate commerce.
Right. But regardless of what they say, it's really not going to change anything. We have a court. We have a court in place, and they're going to be dealing with a full
docket.
But
what I'm saying is I don't think there is liberal – I mean, I think we got a pretty conservative court up there, and we've got five pretty – or four very conservative justices, and I'd include Roberts there.
Where I think that the Republican candidates are correct is in saying that this is going to be an important presidential election. Of course,
right.
We say every year.
Yeah.
We say every year that the presidential election is going to be important to the direction of the court. And when you really get when it gets down to October, nobody's paying any attention to what the Supreme Court's direction is going to be. But we could very well have. I mean, Justice Ginsburg could retire over the next 4 years. She's on one of the more liberal members of the court. It's possible that Justice Kennedy could retire. Justice Scalia there on amongst the older justices. Kennedy is right in the middle of the court, leaning a little bit towards the conservative side, but oftentimes a swing vote. And of course, replacing Scalia by a Democratic appointee would possibly shift things towards the left a little bit. So it isn't going to be an important election, I think.
It would be interesting to know how many people actually think of that part of it, as you've indicated, you know, how important it is in terms of selecting future
Supreme Court
justices.
I think it would be interesting to ask voters, how do you get to be – who appoints a Supreme Court justice? I'd be willing to bet less than half realize it's the president that does that. And, I mean, that's unfortunate.
So I don't think that anybody is going to be moved by it who would not already vote for the party of their choice.
Sure.
But it may stimulate activists on both sides to turn out and work for their election or their candidate because they care about Supreme Court appointments. The voters as a whole, I think, are not focused on it.
Well, there's no question about the importance of it and the fact that when you select a president who appoints Supreme Court justices, that that goes on for more than 8 years of any double term for
a president. It does. And when you have some of these really high-profile issues like abortion, which are basically kind of 5-4, you get a switch. That's a big deal.
And this next term, abortion going to be on the table?
Very likely.
Yeah, I think likely it's there's that Texas law that has been kicking around in the lower courts, the Fifth Circuit Court of Appeals, it has resulted in the closure of quite a number of abortion clinics in Texas. If I was trying to do the numbers off the top of my head, maybe from 40 down to the neighborhood of 10.
This is where they have to have a proximity to a hospital.
Yeah, they have to be close enough to a hospital where the doctor has admitting privileges.
Right. And in that situation, the lower court, the Fifth Circuit, upheld the law, and the Supreme Court put that decision on hold, put the effective date of the law on hold, filing a certiorari petition. They don't do that unless they're probably going to grant that petition. So I think we have a very strong signal they expect to take either this case or a similar case that presents another case that presents a similar issue.
Affirmative action's coming back?
Yeah, also out of Texas. And I think that's going to be a huge case, although I've said this before and I was wrong. But I think there's a good chance that the Supreme Court might just say you cannot consider race in an admissions decision. I think they're heading in that direction.
I don't think that, but I think that the challengers are going to win. And I'll tell you why I think that, even though it's hazardous to make predictions. Last year, the challengers, last time around, the same case was before the court, and the court apparently came very close to adopting something that would be a serious cutback on affirmative action. There's been some reporting by Joan Biskupic, a very good Supreme Court reporter, on what happened behind the scenes. Justice Sotomayor was very passionately opposed, was going to file a fiery dissent, and the court decided, maybe we shouldn't be too quick about this. And so they wrote a very mild opinion and sent it back. And we'll see what the court does on remand. Well, the court on remand upheld the affirmative action plan, and now the court has taken the case again. Why would they take the case? knowing that it was really agonizing for them, knowing everything about the case because they've heard it before, unless they're planning to follow through on the possibility of setting something aside. If they thought they were going to just uphold it, they would just have denied review. But I don't think they'll go as far as Mark says because they weren't willing to do it before. I think they'll adopt something that cuts back on affirmative action.
Of course, it only takes four justices to take a case.
Right.
So one possible explanation would be the four conservative justices want to put pressure on Kennedy, who is the guy in the middle, to go farther with them.
But what I'm saying is normally that would be a good analysis, but in this instance where it was a very painful episode for the court, they're not going to take the case unless they can already foresee where it's headed.
Yeah, and that might influence Roberts being one of the four. I don't see that. I don't see Scalia or Thomas caring about that.
They might want to put Kennedy in a painful situation again.
Right.
I mean, the rest of the story that Ron was talking about is I think that after Sotomayor threatened this or was writing this or maybe even had written this really fiery dissent, that I believe it was Breyer who went to Kennedy and said, hey, this is going to really – make it look bad, really split the court. It's going to be bad situation. And then Kennedy backed off of where he had been.
Another issue that I gather could resurface before the court is Obamacare. There's another instance in which federal judges have been involved in that.
Yeah, so there was a decision this month. I don't know how long it will take actually. It would take to get to the court, but there was a decision this month by a district court judge saying that the House could sue the federal government over federal subsidies paid to health insurers to make up for costs of keeping copays low. And the legal rationale is the House as a whole is being – it can claim it's being harmed because its power of the purse is at stake. And so, maybe the Obama administration can't just like redirect money to these insurers without getting it officially appropriated by the House. Now, the Obama administration claims it was appropriated by the House. So we'll see. It's got a ways to go.
They do claim that, but also I think their strongest argument, the Obama administration's strongest argument is that the House cannot bring suit over this issue. And I think the vast bulk of precedent supports that view. What the judge did was very surprising. Usually Congress has no standing to challenge something by the executive just because they disapprove. That's left to people who are actually injured by it. Well, the House wishes that the administration wouldn't do it, but that doesn't mean that they are injured in the way that the courts usually look to find.
And this would be an easy way for the Supreme Court out. You just rule on the standing issue and then the whole thing goes away.
I think it probably won't even get there because they'll probably be reversed in the Court of Appeals.
All right. Well, it's clearly, if folks who are opposed to Obamacare just kind of nibble away at this thing and every entry portal that they can find to challenge this thing along.
But another case is coming along and probably will get there on the religious exemption issue. Mm-hmm. Because they ruled a year or two ago in the Hobby Lobby case that an employer, a religiously affiliated employer, that objects to providing health insurance itself because they think contraception is abortion and so forth, doesn't have to do it because all they have to do is notify the insurer or the government that they don't want to do it, and then the government should do it, can take care of it from there. So the administration revised its regulations to allow that. But now some groups are saying, we don't even want to do that. We don't even want to notify you because that implicates us in the sin of coverage. Well, six circuits have ruled against that position, but just in the last week or two, the Eighth Circuit in a Missouri case ruled the other way. We now have a split in the circuit, so it'll probably get back to the court.
But I think this nibbling actually cuts in favor of Obamacare for two reasons. One, it's kind of the what doesn't kill me makes me stronger. I mean, you've had all these attacks on Obamacare. They keep coming through. They get a little bit. And then I've heard some people say it's been kind of a success, that Obamacare, more people are being covered. Now some people disagree with that. But as you have more people being covered, it makes it harder to strike down this law and take away health insurance. So the status quo kind of starts supporting it more, I think.
Could it? Is it conceivable that the court could say, in spite of these various cases that are have been floating around, hey, you know, we've already dealt with Obamacare enough already. I mean, could they do that and just say
we? Well, they don't have to grant cert, but they're different arguments.
Yeah. Yeah, I know they are.
They do have a doctrine of like race adjudicata, you know, things we already solved, decided we're not going to do again. But these are all distinct legal issues, so that's not it doesn't fall under that doctrine.
So I think in the case of the first one that we talked about, the court doesn't want to touch the validity of Obamacare anymore.
Yeah.
The religious one, it really deals with a very narrow question, and it only deals with a very small slice of people being covered or not. So that could potentially get to the court, although I don't actually believe that the challenge there will succeed.
It doesn't sound like either of these cases we've talked about, though, have the capability of derailing Obamacare.
No. I agree.
Yeah, that's very unlikely.
Yeah. Okay, I'm going to take our next break and do that now and come back and talk about unless – is there anything about else regarding the court that we want to get to before this break? We've talked about a couple of things that are likely to come before the next session. Anything we missed that we want to get to?
I think one thing that I saw percolating up that may or may not get there is the possibility of looking at the Gardner decision, which we've talked about before, which is the police use of force. It's way down in the pipeline, may not even get there. But because we've talked about it so much, be interesting to see if that gets
just refresh my memory.
So whether or not a police officer can use force, like with a fleeing felon, and just further the Supreme Court further defining when it's appropriate, not appropriate to use lethal force.
Okay.
We'll see.
We'll see. Stay tuned, as we say in radio. Back in just a moment, continuing our legal roundtable conversation with Mark Smith, Ron Levin, and Bill Freivogel. Stay with us. This is St. Louis on the Air on St. Louis Public Radio, 90.7 KWMU. Hello again and welcome back as we continue our conversation with our legal roundtable panel. I'd like to bring another story that has been getting a lot of attention into our discussion. That would involve Kim Davis, who has been getting a lot of attention in Kentucky for failing to issue same-sex or marriage licenses to same-sex couples. She's back on the job now after spending 5 days, I think it was, in jail for doing that and violating of judge's orders. But now she may be in another violation, as I understand it, in that she's changing some of the language on some of the paperwork, and this could diminish the validity of any of these licenses that are issued. Thoughts? Is she, do you think, in violation? And
Well, I actually think – I mean, most of what I've read of various lawyers looking at what she's done, most of them have said they think that she is probably technically in violation of the judge's order. What she did was she told the deputy clerk who's been issuing these things to, you know, take – she's confiscated all of the marriage license forms that they had and had a new form in which they just – they don't specifically mention the county. They say the name of the county is there, but it doesn't say county of. There's no reference to a clerk. Her name's off of it. There's no reference to the deputy clerk having that position. It just he signs it as a notary public. Now the governor has said those marriage licenses are valid. And so, you know, maybe that is resolving things. But, you know, the question you asked was, is she violating the order? She was ordered to not directly or indirectly interfere. And I think there are quite a few people think that what she has done amounts to at least indirect, if not direct, interference.
But it is not interference if, in fact, the forms are valid.
If they're valid.
Right.
Well, so it's not completely obstructing the marriages that are still going on with these substitute forms. And as long as that happens, I think there may not be much furor.
Yeah.
Because It won't matter that much. Now, I think Kim Davis is pushing the envelope a little bit and trying to dissociate herself even more than she has from this process by saying, oh, wait, don't put your signature on there, Mr. Deputy Clerk. Put your initials. And she's just trying to cut back. It might be that she kind of enjoys the celebrity martyr role, or it might be that her conscience just tells her there's a difference between the stripped-down form and the That's original right. form. But whichever it is, as long as the licenses continue to be issued, then probably things will kind of stabilize. But if she pushes it too far, then the fact that she's technically in violation now, which she is, may lead to her going back to jail.
Now in Missouri, we have a similar thing happening where some judges who have the ability to perform marriages, but they're not required to do that, have decided that they're not going to perform marriages anymore for anyone. And I think that's probably legally okay. I think if they said we were only going to do it for certain people and not other people, that would be more problematic. And if it said they shall require that they were required, shall perform marriages, that would be different. But I don't think we have a problem. Those judges have a problem. They just decided, I'm not going to do this extra work.
But I do think this whole area of religious freedom is going to be a big legal and political issue going forward, both in the presidential election and in the courts. Religious freedom as it relates to same-sex marriage, and also, as Ron was just saying before the break, religious freedom as it relates to Obamacare.
But one of the issues that occurs to me is the people who accept these altered licenses and get married, you know, have to wonder if at some point, that marriage is going to be considered valid. I mean, wouldn't you take
my
it to court?
My understanding, though, is she's doing that for all license. She's not creating two separate types of license.
I think that's correct. And I think that most people think that as long as the governor and maybe I don't know if the attorney general
also
has said that they're legal, that no one's very likely to be able to come back in 10 years or 5 years and say, hey, that wasn't ever a legal marriage.
Right. And the disparity is that now these substitute forms are being used in Kim Davis's county and not all the other counties. And so you could have someone who says, gosh, I really wish I had a form that was the same as everybody else's form in the other counties. But that's not likely to lead to a legal dispute unless someone comes in and
you can prove some kind of deficit or something.
So it would be very hard to prove the discriminatory choice. Yeah. No one's going to bother.
Yeah,
as long as they're allowed to get married.
All right, we'll move on to something else. We have a call coming in from Chesterfield that I'll take before Scott gets tired of waiting. So Scott, come on into the conversation. Go ahead.
Yeah. Thanks, Don. Do you remember I think it was South Carolina where the guy is running away from the police officer and he shoots him and it's on video. And, the South Carolina the mayor charged him, somebody charged him with something. In Missouri, would that have been legal?
All right. This is the case, I think, where the officer is accused of dropping a gun.
Right.
Yeah, and I think he's actually been charged. I think he's been charged with murder.
I thought so too.
I don't think in Missouri that even under the statute that what you saw on that video would be considered to be a justifiable use of force by the police. But it would certainly be a harder case to make under the way the Missouri statute is written.
Right.
And the Missouri statute is quite different from most places, as I recall, is it not? And this is something that, again, was not addressed by the legislature.
Right.
Yeah, but we were saying before that the Missouri statute is written more broadly than the federal constitutional law allows. Yeah. So I think from a constitutional level, the question regarding the South Carolina incident would be whether the officer had reasonable fear of danger to himself or to anybody else. And Missouri law, the statute is written more broadly, and it would seem it should be a no-brainer to correct the scope of the Missouri statute to what the federal constitution allows, but there seem to be members of the legislature to whom constitutionality is not a particularly relevant consideration when they decide what laws to pass.
And the reason it's complicated, you would normally think that, well, you know, the federal constitutional standard should trump whatever Missouri's law is, because usually the federal constitution trumps the state laws that disagree with it. But actually, you know, the federal constitutional standard is in a civil context.
Not a criminal
right. context. And a police officer would be prosecuted in a criminal context. And so he would most likely be able to avail himself of the Missouri statute.
Okay. I stand corrected then.
Go ahead. Can you hear me?
Go ahead.
Yeah, I think the Missouri law says that if the person is fleeing and is not surrendering, that the officer can kill him.
Yeah, it does. It does say that. I mean, that's why I think it would be harder to convict the police officer. But I guess I still feel as though under, you know, the context of that entire stop, there'd be it's very hard for the police officer to defend what he did, even under that kind of a statute.
Scott, thank you so much for the call. Let's take one more. This one from Afton before we move on. It's Tom. Go ahead, Tom.
Thanks, Don. You know, about the that use of force statute, in the Ferguson Commission report, there's something like over 100 recommendations. Some of them are recommendations about legal rights, like the use of force stuff. Others are policy recommendations. And, you know, I've been marching in the demonstrations. I care a lot about black people, and I'm against racism. And I care a lot about poor people, and I want to address that. But the thing that I care about most of all is that our constitutional rights are equally applied to all American citizens. And my question is, having those issues of rights buried in there with 100 other recommendations, isn't there a chance that they'll be diluted or lose focus?
Well, let's see. Tom, thanks for the call. I think there are 189 or 187 or 189 recommendations.
And the report's almost 200 pages.
Yeah.
Right.
I mean, I did feel like I think Ron was saying earlier that, you know, some of these recommendations like minimum wage and Medicaid expansion, while maybe really good policies and things that I personally am in favor of, I think they do tend a little bit to dilute the really specific recommendations relating to police and to the courts. I mean, I think there's some really good recommendations we haven't talked about that are in that report, like trying to consolidate some of the municipal courts.
Right.
I mean, I think it's very possible that we'll end up getting some consolidation of municipal courts along the lines of the three St. Louis County municipal courts.
Missouri Supreme Court is looking at that right now.
Right. You know, in general, the idea of citizen review boards is a good idea, although I guess the recommendation is for every police department to establish a civilian review board. And I think that could be a little bit unworkable, but it's at least along the right idea. There's lots of suggestions for improved training of police officers, you know, more hours of training on police use of force. And I think that those things are quite likely to happen.
But to speak to Tom's point, this is what you get when you have a very broad-based commission, which is appointed with the very idea of bringing together a wide variety of participants. So, of course, you're going to get a lot of ideas with a great deal of diversity of ideas. And it's now up to the political leadership to choose among them the ones that are likely to do some good and that are feasible and that are at least within the realm of political plausibility.
I think that commission was pretty much – they were damned no matter what they ended up doing, because if you narrowed it down to say these are the most important things, you know, when I went to those meetings, you've got everyone in the community there. They let them – you can't ignore what these people are saying and bringing forward. And they were saying we're trying to look at underlying causes, but –
They heard from 2,000 people during their 9 months. I mean, that's an awful lot of input.
They were just huge.
A couple of other things I certainly want to get to before our time is up. One is the Hillsborough transgender suit, which has gotten a lot of attention. Does the law entitle Lisa Perry to use a ladies' room as opposed to a gender-neutral facility? Apparently some federal funding at risk here in connection with this particular issue. There have been several school board resignations. What about that? Does the law protect Lisa and enable her to use the ladies' room if she so chooses?
Well, if you ask the Department of Justice, the answer you'll get is yes. But court decisions on this point have mostly said no. And so I think that you do have a trend in the law developing. And one of these days, that track record is going to change and there'll be more positive and fewer negative decisions. I don't think that is what you'll usually get these days. I think that in the short run, the way courts have looked at this by saying there are privacy rights on the side of the other students in the school, and those are also important, and so we're not going to override the school board on an issue like this.
I think we've talked about this before. You know, the law is not always good when society is changing and when technology is changing. And this is one, I think, where society is changing. The law has rules that were set in place a while ago when maybe people had different ideas, and I think ideas are continuing to change as people start thinking about gender as maybe being more nuanced and not just particular body parts, but how you view yourself internally, how you present externally, who you're attracted to, and then body parts is one component.
Isn't there a locker room issue as well here?
Yeah, but I mean, you could say that about if I'm using the men's locker room and there are gay men in there, do I get worked up about that or not? And you could also do things. I mean, you have locker rooms that are huge areas with all the showers, but a lot of times there are ones where they're, you know, you put up a couple of curtains or something. I mean, I think I'm not saying to the transgender student, you have to go to a different place. I'm not saying that. But what I'm saying is there may be ways to increase everyone's privacy and comfort level that don't bring things to a head. But it's a tough issue, I think.
I mean, one thing to keep in mind is that even though we've had this watershed Supreme Court decision on same-sex marriage, that still there's not a federal law that bars discrimination against gays, lesbians, and transgendered persons. Nor do most states, about half the states have laws that bar that kind of discrimination. About half the states do not. Missouri does not. And so we're at a place where those laws are changing, but there's still quite a few of the older ones in place.
So if I could add to what I said before, there are recent decisions in Pennsylvania and Virginia that rejected these claims, but the student won in Maine. And the difference there was that Maine has a statute that explicitly provides civil rights protection based on sexual orientation, and it specifically says gender identity is part of it. Well, if you get legislation that recognizes that type of claims, I think courts will be readier to uphold claims like the one pending in Hillsborough.
Well, the gay rights issue moved very quickly. Once it got a full head of steam, it moved very quickly. Yeah. And this looks like it's building some momentum as well. Just 2 minutes left. I wanted to bring up the Illinois lottery suit. A couple of winners have
filed. You got some winning tickets, Don?
No, I wish, I wish I did.
Of course, actually, it wouldn't matter now.
If I did, they wouldn't pay me. And that's the whole issue. They're filing because Illinois, with its financial problems, can only afford to pay $25,000
max. I think they're
max.
Only statutorily authorized to pay up to that amount.
Well, this seems like a pretty good case. They've got $288 million out there that people are expecting to be paid at some point. Is that a good case, do you think?
Well, in the abstract, it's a very good case because it's like a contract. The problem is that Illinois has a budget shortfall, and I feel sorry for the lottery winners, but I also feel sorry for the people in higher education, highways, law enforcement, all the other people who are not getting the money that they should be getting because the legislature hasn't gotten its budget act together. It's like the the budget shutdown, the government shutdown, we may be getting at the national level within a week or two.
So, Ron, your legal Congress advice doesn't is get its... buy your lottery tickets in Missouri. That's what your bottom line legal
absolutely.
Advice is. Okay, good.
The bottom line is you can't squeeze, you know, blood from a stone, right. And if there's no money, there's no money. But I can hardly blame them for filing suit. Any final thought?
I was just going to say Illinois is probably the only place where the legislature and the government is in a greater mess than the United States Congress.
So. Yeah, and that card has yet to be played. Well, that's it for us today, gentlemen. Thank you so much for being with us. Ron Levin, great to see you again. Thanks for your input.
Thanks for the invitation.
Mark Smith, great to have you with us once more. And Bill Frivol, of course, nice to have you with us as well. Thanks so much. We'll get together in a month or so when the Supreme Court is underway. And tomorrow in St. Louis on the Air, we'll air the first hour of the discussion I'll moderate tonight at Wellspring Church in downtown Ferguson, addressing the question of where we go from here following the release of the Ferguson Commission report. You are invited to be a part of the audience. Doors open at 6:15 and the conversation begins at 7 o'clock. More information is available at stlpublicradio.org/STL on air, where you can also find archived versions of past St. Louis on the Air programs. St. Louis on the Air is a production of St. Louis Public Radio, 90.7 KWMU. Thank you so much for listening. I'm Don Marsh.